A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts from something we talked about before. Israel's revolving door breakaway parties and the chaos that creates. But his real question is deeper. He's asking, if the political system itself is broken, who actually fixes it? Legislators are embedded in the system. They benefit from it. They may not even see past it. So who designs reform? Who pushes it through? And who funds that work? He points to institutions like the Israel Democracy Institute and the Movement for Quality of Government, and he's honest that he doesn't fully understand what they do, whether they're watchdogs barking at the government or whether they're actually formulating alternatives. And he wants to know how this works in other countries too.
This is the question that's been sitting under everything we've talked about with coalition instability. Five elections between April 2019 and November 2022. And the mechanism is straightforward. A minority coalition partner can bring down the government by walking away, because the threshold for entering the Knesset is so low that tiny factions hold disproportionate leverage.
3.25%. One of the lowest thresholds among proportional representation systems anywhere. You can get into the Knesset with roughly 4 seats worth of votes, and suddenly, you're the person who decides whether the Prime Minister keeps his job.
Germany looked at exactly this problem in 1949 and solved it with a single constitutional mechanism. Article 67 of the Basic Law, the constructive vote of no confidence. You cannot bring down a chancellor unless you simultaneously elect a replacement. No power vacuums, no hostage taking by junior coalition partners. The parliamentary council that drafted the Basic Law had watched the Weimar Republic collapse under precisely this kind of fragmentation, and they designed a structural fix that has held for over 75 years.
The question Daniel's really asking is, who are the people who do that kind of design work? Who looks at a broken system and says, here's the specific mechanism causing the dysfunction, here's the targeted fix, and here's how we build enough consensus to actually pass it. Because the politicians inside the system aren't going to do it unprompted.
Right. And that's where the Israel Democracy Institute and the Movement for Quality of Government come in. But they're not the same thing, and that distinction is exactly what Daniel's getting at when he says the names sound ambiguous and opaque. Most people don't know the difference between a watchdog and a reform engineer.
Let's unpack that. What does the Israel Democracy Institute actually do?
Founded in 1991, and they describe themselves as an independent center of research and action dedicated to strengthening democracy. Not just research, research and action. They produce policy papers, propose legislation, constitutional drafts. Their Constitution by Consensus project produced an entire draft constitution for Israel. These are not people who just write op-eds complaining about the government. They're drafting the actual legal text of what a reform system would look like.
They're a think tank with a drafting desk attached.
They publish detailed proposals for electoral reform, raising the threshold, introducing regional representation, stabilizing coalition agreements. In 2018, they proposed a stability government model that would require a supermajority to dissolve the Knesset. That's a specific, actionable mechanism. You could take that proposal and introduce it as legislation tomorrow.
The Movement for Quality of Government.
Founded the year earlier, in 1990, and their tool is the courtroom, not the drafting table. They petition the Supreme Court against political appointments they consider corrupt, against violations of transparency, against conflicts of interest. In 2020, they petitioned against the appointment of a minister who was under criminal indictment. That's enforcement of existing rules, not designing new ones.
The distinction matters. IDI is saying, here's a better system, let's build political consensus around it. MQG is saying, you're breaking the current system, we'll see you in court.
Both are necessary. You need someone to enforce the rules you have, and you need someone to design better rules for the future. But they're fundamentally different jobs, and most people lump them together as organizations that criticize the government.
Which brings us to the funding question. Because if you're going to criticize the government, you can't be funded by the government.
IDI is funded by philanthropic foundations, the Rothschild Foundation, other private donors, not government money. MQG is membership-based with additional foundation support. That independence is structural, not rhetorical. They can propose reforms or file lawsuits without worrying about their budget being cut by the politicians they're targeting.
That's the pattern internationally, too. You look at Germany, and the constructive vote of no confidence didn't come from a think tank. It came from the Parliamentary Council that drafted the Basic Law in 1948 and 49. Constitutional founders, not reform advocates working within the existing system. They had the advantage of a clean slate after a catastrophic collapse.
Which raises the uncomfortable question, does meaningful political reform require a crisis first? Germany got its basic law after Weimar collapsed. Israel's 1992 reform introducing direct election of the prime minister came after a governance crisis, and then it was repealed in 2001 after it made things worse.
A reform that increased instability. That's a cautionary tale about designing fixes without fully understanding the system you're tinkering with.
That's precisely why institutions like IDI matter. They do the long-term modeling and research to understand what a proposed change would actually do to the system, rather than just reacting to the latest political crisis with a quick fix. The direct election reform was a political compromise, not a research structural solution, and it backfired.
Daniel's question, who pushes reform? Who funds it? How does it actually work? It turns out to be a question about the invisible infrastructure of democracy itself. The institutions that maintain the plumbing while everyone's watching the circus.
The Kaizen approach he mentions, incremental improvement, that's exactly what these organizations are trying to do. Not revolution, not tearing everything down. Targeted fixes to specific pain points, built on research, advanced through consensus, building over years or decades.
Which is less exciting than a political crisis, but probably more effective.
Let's trace the actual mechanism. Because the 3.25% threshold isn't just a number, it's the root of the instability. In a proportional system, the threshold determines how many votes a party needs to enter parliament. Israel's is set so low that a faction representing roughly 140,000 voters can claim seats. That creates a Knesset with sometimes a dozen or more parties and coalition governments that need to stitch together 5, 6, 7 of them just to reach 61 seats.
Any one of those factions, even the smallest one, can walk away and collapse the majority. You don't need a majority to bring down a government. You just need one coalition partner to defect. The government falls, and suddenly the country is back at the polls.
Germany's Article 67 eliminates that leverage entirely. The Bundestag cannot express no confidence in the chancellor unless it simultaneously elects a successor by majority vote. It's not a veto, it's a replacement mechanism. A junior coalition partner can be furious about some policy, but walking away doesn't trigger new elections. It just means they're no longer in government, and the chancellor keeps governing, possibly by finding a new partner or governing as a minority until a constructive majority forms.
The threat loses its teeth. You can't hold the government hostage because the hostage has already been moved to a different room.
And the Parliamentary Council in 1948 and 49 designed this deliberately. They'd watched the Weimar Republic, 14 coalition governments in 14 years, constant fragmentation, parties pulling down chancellors with no alternative ready. The constructive vote of no confidence was their answer to a specific pathology, the negative majority, where parties that agree on nothing except opposing the current government can combine to destroy it without being able to build anything in its place.
Which sounds painfully familiar to anyone watching Israeli politics. And this brings us back to Daniel's central question with sharper focus. If the fix is known, Article 67 has been working for over 7 decades, and if legislators embedded in the current system can't or won't adopt it, then who actually does the work of translating a known solution into political reality?
That's where the Israel Democracy Institute gets interesting, because they're not just writing papers that sit on a shelf. They've actually built what amounts to a reform to legislation pipeline. Their researchers draft the legal text, they shop it to Knesset members across parties, they host closed-door seminars where politicians can discuss structural changes without committing publicly. It's quiet, unglamorous, and completely invisible to most voters.
Which is probably why most voters don't know what they do. The public-facing work of IDI, the reports, the conferences, the occasional op-ed, that's the tip of the iceberg. The actual reform engineering happens in rooms nobody's filming.
That's the deliberate strategy. If you announce a comprehensive reform plan with fanfare, every party that benefits from the current fragmentation immediately mobilizes against it. The smaller parties, and there are a lot of them, see any threshold increase or stability mechanism as an existential threat. So IDI builds consensus quietly, one Knesset member at a time over years.
Which raises a question about effectiveness. They've been at this since 1991, 35 years, and Israel still has the 3.25% threshold, still has coalition hostage taking, still has revolving elections. What's actually moved?
Fair question, and the honest answer is that structural electoral reform hasn't passed, but that's not the only measure of impact. IDI's research has shaped judicial appointments, government transparency requirements, and the debate around a formal constitution. Their draft constitution, the Constitution by Consensus Project, became a reference document that every serious constitutional discussion in Israel now engages with. You don't need to win the vote to change the terms of the debate.
They're playing a long game where moving the Overton window on reform is itself a form of progress.
And compare that to the Movement for Quality of Government, which operates on a completely different timeline. MQG files a petition, the Supreme Court rules, and something changes, or doesn't, within months. Their 2020 petition against appointing a minister under indictment forced a high-profile legal confrontation that shaped public understanding of what's permissible. That's immediate, tangible impact. But it doesn't redesign the system. It enforces the system as it exists.
MQG is the emergency room. They treat the patient who's bleeding right now. IDI is the public health researcher designing a better diet so people don't end up in the emergency room in the first place.
Both are underfunded relative to the scale of the problem they're trying to solve. IDI runs on foundation grants, Rothschild, other private donors, which means their budget depends on convincing philanthropists that democratic infrastructure is worth investing in. MQG relies on membership dues and foundation support. Neither has anything close to the resources of, say, a major American think tank like the Brennan Center, which has an annual budget in the tens of millions.
Which brings us to the German parallel. Because the constructive vote of no confidence wasn't designed by a chronically underfunded think tank working against political headwinds. It was designed by constitutional founders with a mandate and a blank page.
The Parliamentary Council, the Parlamentarische Rat, met in Bonn in 1948 and 49. 65 members, mostly state parliamentarians and legal scholars, operating under Allied supervision but with genuine autonomy on constitutional design. They had Weimar's corpse right in front of them. 14 coalition governments collapsing in 14 years. Article 54 of the Weimar Constitution allowed the Reichstag to dismiss the chancellor with a simple no-confidence vote, no replacement required. The result was negative majorities that could destroy but not build.
They wrote Article 67 as a direct answer to a specific failure mode they'd watched destroy their previous democracy. No abstract theorizing. They were engineering against a known bug.
And this is the uncomfortable contrast with Israel's situation. Germany got its structural fix because the old system had completely collapsed and a new constitutional body had the authority to design its replacement. Israel doesn't have a constitutional moment like that. No single founding document. No parliamentary council with a mandate to redesign the system from scratch.
The reform advocates in Israel are trying to do what the Parlamentarische Rat did, but without the crisis mandate, without the blank page, and while the broken system they're trying to fix is still operating and still producing the politicians whose consent they need.
Which is why it's been 35 years and the threshold is still 3.25%. It's not that the diagnosis is wrong or the solution is unknown. It's that the political physics of reform, getting the beneficiaries of the current system to vote for its replacement, is almost impossibly difficult without a crisis that discredits the status quo.
We're back to the crisis question. Does meaningful reform require the system to break first?
History suggests yes, but with an important caveat. The crisis doesn't have to be Weimar-level collapse. Sometimes it's a slow-burning governance failure that accumulates until even the beneficiaries of the system realize it's unsustainable. 5 elections in under 4 years. That's not Weimar, but it's also not normal. The question is whether that's enough accumulated failure to create an opening.
Let's test that against other countries, because Daniel asked who steps up to the plate in different places. The United States doesn't have a parliamentary system, so the specific mechanism is different. But the question of who reforms political structures is the same. Who does it there?
3 organizations show the pattern. The Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. They do reform advocacy and litigation, closer to MQG's model, but with a research arm that produces detailed legislative proposals on redistricting, voting rights, and campaign finance. They've successfully pushed redistricting reform through in several states. The Committee for Economic Development is different. Business leaders funding governance reform because they see dysfunction as bad for the economy. And the National Conference of State Legislatures provides bipartisan technical assistance to state governments on how to actually implement reforms.
You got the legal advocacy shop, the business-backed reform funder, and the technical implementation body. 3 different functions, none of them inside the legislature itself.
The UK shows a similar pattern. The Constitution Unit at University College London does academic research that feeds into parliamentary reform debates. Pure research, no advocacy. The Electoral Reform Society has campaigned for proportional representation for decades, largely unsuccessful, but they've shaped the terms of the debate so thoroughly that even defenders of first past the post now have to argue against their framework. And the Hansard Society focuses specifically on parliamentary procedure reform.
What's striking is that across all these countries, the successful organizations share 4 characteristics. They're non-partisan or cross-partisan. They focus on process rather than policy outcomes, how decisions get made, not what the decisions are. They commit to long-term consensus, building rather than short-term campaigns, and they're independently funded.
That 4th one is the load-bearing pillar. If your funding depends on the government you're trying to reform, you're not a reform organization, you're a government contractor with opinions. The Brennan Center runs on foundation grants and individual donations. The Constitution Unit gets university funding and research grants. The Electoral Reform Society is membership funded. Independence isn't a virtue signal, it's the operating system.
This maps directly onto Daniel's Kaizen point. Incremental reform requires institutions that can do 4 things in sequence. Diagnose the specific mechanism causing dysfunction. Not just complain that politics is broken, but identify the precise lever that's producing the failure. Design a targeted fix. Build political consensus around it. And sustain pressure over years or decades.
Israel's challenge is that the diagnosis has been done. The 3.25% threshold is the mechanism. The fixes have been designed, raised a threshold, introduced regional seats, require constructive, no confidence. IDI has published all of this. But step 3, building political consensus, hits a wall because the fragmented parties that would need to vote for reform are the same parties that would be eliminated by it.
It's the classic reformer's paradox. The people whose votes you need are the people whose power you're trying to reduce.
That's where the crisis question becomes inescapable. Germany's parliamentary council didn't need to convince Weimar's fragmented parties to abolish themselves. Those parties had already been destroyed by the collapse of the system. The 1992 Israeli reform introducing direct prime ministerial elections passed because a governance crisis had made the status quo temporarily unacceptable even to its beneficiaries.
Then it got repealed 9 years later because it made fragmentation worse. Which is the nightmare scenario for reform. You finally break through the political barriers, pass a change, and discover you've engineered a new failure pattern that's even harder to fix.
The direct election reform created a split-ticket dynamic where voters would choose a prime minister from one party and then vote for a different party in the Knesset, producing even more fragmentation. It solved one problem by creating a worse one. That's why IDI's slow, research-heavy approach matters. They model the knock-on effect before proposing changes, rather than rushing a political compromise into law.
The question hanging over all of this is whether 5 elections in under 4 years constitutes enough accumulated failure. Not Weimar-level collapse, but enough that even the small parties start to see that a system that produces permanent instability eventually produces a public that stops distinguishing between the parties at all.
If you're a listener who cares about this stuff, and given that you've made it this far into a conversation about electoral thresholds, you probably do. What do you actually do? Where do you put your attention or your money?
Daniel's essentially asking for a framework. How do you tell the difference between an organization that's actually advancing reform and one that's just performing concern?
First, do they produce specific, actionable reform proposals or just general criticism? If you go to their website and all you find is statements condemning the government, that's watchdogging. Valuable, but not reform engineering. IDI publishes draft legislation. The Brennan Center writes model bills that state legislatures introduce verbatim. That's the difference.
Second question. Do they engage in long-term consensus building or just short-term campaigns? Reform takes years. If an organization's entire strategy is press releases and social media outrage cycles, they're not building the quiet political coalitions that actually pass structural changes.
Third, are they independently funded? If a government can defund them, they're not an independent reform advocate. IDI runs on foundation money. MQG is membership-based. The Electoral Reform Society in the UK is funded by its members. That independence isn't a nice-to-have. It's the structural precondition for honest criticism.
The German lesson here is oddly encouraging. The constructive vote of no confidence is a single mechanism. It didn't require rewriting the entire constitutional order. It was a targeted fix to a specific pain point. The Parliamentary Council identified the negative majority problem and designed exactly the tool needed to solve it.
Which means reform doesn't have to be comprehensive constitutional overhaul. You don't need to solve everything at once. You need to identify the specific mechanism producing the dysfunction and design a precise intervention. For Israel, that mechanism is the 3.25% threshold combined with the absence of a constructive no-confidence requirement. You don't need to redesign the entire Knesset.
For Israeli listeners specifically, the practical takeaway is that IDI and MQG are doing complementary work, and knowing the difference matters. If you want to support structural reform, new rules, better mechanisms, a system less prone to hostage-taking, IDI's research to legislation pipeline is the model to fund. If you want to enforce the rules that already exist, MQG's litigation is the model.
Neither one replaces the other. A country with strong enforcement of bad rules still has bad rules. A country with beautifully designed reforms that nobody enforces has paper democracy. You need both.
The meta insight, and I think this is what Daniel's really driving at, is that democracy is a system that needs maintenance. It's not a statue you build once and admire. It's plumbing. Pipes corrode, pressure builds up in weird places, and if nobody's maintaining the infrastructure, eventually something bursts.
The people who do that maintenance, the researchers drafting constitutional amendments nobody reads, the lawyers filing transparency petitions, the foundation program, officers deciding that democratic infrastructure is worth funding. They're almost entirely invisible. Most citizens have never heard of them. But they may be the most important democratic infrastructure most people don't know exists.
The question isn't whether reform is needed. It's who has the expertise, the independence, and the patience to do the work when the political system can't or won't repair itself.
Here's the open question I keep turning over. 5 elections in under 4 years. April 2019, September 2019, March 2020, March 2021, November 2022. Is that enough accumulated failure to force structural reform, or does the system just keep fragmenting until it becomes genuinely ungovernable?
The uncomfortable answer is that nobody knows the threshold. Weimar took 14 coalition collapses before the whole thing came apart. Israel's at 5. Is that a warning light or just the new normal?
The danger of the new normal is that it stops feeling like a crisis. The circus becomes background noise, and the window for reform, which usually opens when the pain is acute, quietly closes.
Which is why the institutions we've been talking about matter so much. They're the ones who keep working when the crisis isn't acute enough to force action, but the dysfunction is real enough to cause damage. That's not glamorous work. Nobody gives awards for drafting electoral threshold legislation that doesn't pass. But it's the difference between a democracy that eventually repairs itself and one that just slowly rusts.
Every democracy faces this. The challenge of self-repair is universal. The institutions that do it are poorly understood, often underfunded, and almost completely invisible to the public they're trying to serve. And yet, they may be the most important democratic infrastructure most people have never heard of.
If this episode sparked a question about political reform in your own country, who's doing this work where you live, how they're funded, whether they're actually designing fixes or just performing concern, send it in. We'll do a follow-up comparing reform institutions across more democracies.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, naturalists documented that an octopus's chromatophores, the pigment sacs that enable its color changes, are controlled not by slow hormonal signals, but by direct neural impulses, meaning the animal essentially thinks its skin into a new pattern at speeds faster than the human eye can track.
An octopus is just a brain wearing a live optical display.
I have no follow-up to that.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for that. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, send your own questions to show at myweirdprompts.com. We're here every week, and we read everything you send.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.